Well, if you have your Bibles open to Hebrews chapter 1 this morning, we're going to be in the book of Hebrews chapter 1, verses 4 to 14. As you're turning there, I'll just say, maybe it's probably a few years ago. I'm not as much now because I can't stay up late anymore, but I used to kind of really get into Fallon. And for a while ago, he had a segment that he did, which was called In Reply To. And what he would do in this is that he would show you a second tweet. And the question was, what provoked that tweet? What was it in response to? And so let me kind of give you a little sense of how this worked in that segment. Here is one in which he pulls up a tweet from Barack Obama in which he says, it's a desperate group of people trying to get our attention, but we must do our best to ignore them. So you might be wondering, what was Obama tweeting towards? What was he responding to? Well, here was the originating tweet that prompted that response when he said this. Someone asked him, describe Dancing with the Stars. To get a little sense of how this works now. Here's a second one in which someone had tweeted at Uber, and Uber tweeted back, you simply get into the car of a stranger and they take you to your final destination. The question was, what was that in reply to? And it was this one, describe a murder, all right? I don't think that was great for Uber's brand, but that's not neither here nor there, all right? I don't know if you've ever walked up on the second half of a conversation and thought, I don't know how we got here, I don't know what's going on. I still remember, it's probably about a spring break some years ago where I was traveling and we came up in the airport to check our bags and there were two young college students that were talking with each other, seemingly agitated, and one of them said, I'm so frustrated, I could take my pants off and strangle you with them right now, right here. I remember thinking, I don't think that's appropriate, okay? But also, I'd love to know what happened in the last 2 minutes that kind of got to that moment, because that seems a little extreme. What we're going to see in Hebrews chapter 1 this morning is that the writer of Hebrews is going to be speaking about angels and talking about the fact that Jesus is better than angels. And I don't know about you, but angels isn't something I'm often thinking about or talking about. And particularly what was going on in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 4 to 14 is one that you would make you and I think, what was this in reply to? Why in the world was the writer of Hebrews going to say to his audience what he's going to say to them about angels in this section in chapter 1 of the book of Hebrews? Because you and I often don't have a context for angels. In fact, when you and I think of angels, this is typically what you and I think of, right? Some kind of like infantile toddler body. In this case, we have young kid faces, but in some pictures of angels, I'll see like adult 40-year-old faces on child bodies. Very weird, right? With little wings that really, what are those going to do? Those wings aren't going to take you anywhere, right? And since it's Easter, apparently these angels are getting ready for an Easter egg hunt and they're carrying ducks because that's what angels do, right? No, like I don't know what it is that you think about with angels, but I think for the writer of the book of Hebrews and for his audience and really the biblical portrait shows angels to be something much more like this, right? Something that could, with the wings that could really take you somewhere and way more fierce, way more intimidating, way more intense, right? Or how about something like this? That I don't know what it is that you think of when it comes to angels, but for the writer of the book of Hebrews, for his audience, and I think the biblical portrait, it's much more something like this. And for the audience of the book of Hebrews, they viewed angels this way, but they didn't just have the correct view of angels, but they went a little too far with angels. Because we know from commentaries, and we're going to see, according to this passage, as he responds to what was going on, that they actually worshiped angels and they revered angels to a place and to an extent that was inappropriate. They not only did they worship angels, but they began to view angels as those that were going to rule the coming kingdom that was to come. They ended up placing angels in a place in their life that they attributed their satisfaction and even their security to angels. And when the writer of Hebrews is going to do this, he's going to go, no, let's back this up. In fact, I need you to see that Jesus is better than angels. And so your response to these angels is inappropriate. And they become, if anything, much more like an idol in your life than what they are intended to be. In fact, idols are those things that provide us a sense of security and the satisfaction that we place our hopes, our dreams, our expectations upon. Often you and I can't identify the idols in our lives until something is often removed from our life and it creates a chaos. It creates an instability because all of a sudden our very sense of satisfaction and our sense of security gets threatened in a way that is often the only way that sometimes we can identify an idol in our life. As John Calvin, that's referring to idols, said this, that every one of us is, even from his mother's womb, a master craftsman of idols. Now, we don't make statues and bend down to them in the way that they did in ancient times, but every single one of us has built and established idols in our hearts that if we're honest with ourselves, it's where we place our sense of satisfaction and even our place of security, that these are these things in our lives that whether it's accomplishment, whether it's approval, whether it's achievement, whether it's our bank account, whether it's a set of circumstances, some things in our lives that often are our source for satisfaction and security. Thomas Owen put it this way, speaking of idols, when he said that one has a God when a finite value is worshiped and adored and viewed as that without which one cannot receive life joyfully. It's this quote that I think helps us often find what those idols are in our lives, because we wouldn't necessarily say that something that's secondary in our life is our source of security and satisfaction. But often you and I realize what is secondary has become primary when that thing becomes removed from our life, and it creates a chaos, it creates an instability, it creates a desperation that reveals that all of a sudden that which was secondary had become primary, and we cannot fathom life apart from this thing. What the writer of Hebrews is going to do for his audience, he's going to say that these angels have become like idols to them, that they become something that was secondary that's become primary, and he's going to reset the order of things for his audience. And I'm going to say by extension for you and I. You and I might have a false view of angels, but often what they were doing with angels is what we do with idols. And so it's going to be just as relevant and applicable for us as we begin to recognize that Jesus is better than not just the angels, but he's better than our idols. That's where the writer of Hebrews is going to take his audience. That's where he's going to take us this morning in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 4 to 14. As we jump in, he's going to make the argument that Jesus is better for two reasons in two ways. The first is going to be this. He's going to say that Jesus gets a better title than the angels. And notice chapter 1, verse 4. Notice where the writer takes us and where we begin. Speaking of verse 4 of Jesus, he says that Jesus, having become as much better than the angels as he's inherited a more excellent name than they. This is the first reason why we can put stock in the fact that Jesus is better than the angels, is because Jesus has a more excellent name than they do. Verses 5 and on, we'll talk about what that name is, but names have significance. Some of you may not know this. This is a moment of vulnerability for me, but my legal name is Huey Corey, all right? You don't know that because what utter shame and atrocity that my parents did to me by naming me legally Huey, right? It was a family name, and so the first day of elementary school, first, second, third, fourth grade, roll call comes, Huey Corey, are you here? I raise my hand, identify myself, and every kid in my grade starts laughing at me. Huey, Dewey, Louie, the ducks that I grew up with, right? I'm still in counseling because of it, because names have significance, all right? I still remember in our young married days, there was a couple that was having their first baby. It was this huge moment, this huge significance of what are we gonna name the child? And throughout pregnancy, they could not reach agreement as to what they were going to name the child, which is fine and it's cute and all. We're all having little young married fights. And then you kind of get to like you're a month out from that due date. Like you still don't know what you're gonna name the child. They had the child in the hospital. They're holding the child and they still had not agreed upon the name of the child. They're 2 months after the birth of the child and they still have not agreed upon the name of the child. They eventually would settle on the fact that the husband just finally gave way and said, fine, honey, you can have the name, right? Names have significance. We battle around names. We have difficulties and stresses around names. Names are important. The name that the writer of Hebrews is going to attribute to Jesus is going to come up in verse 5. Notice what the writer tells us. For to which of the angels did he ever say, you are my son, today I have begotten you. And again, I will be a father to him and he shall be a son to me. The name that Jesus gets, the title that Jesus gets is one that no one else gets. It's the Son of God. That as son, he shares the same exact representation as the father. Notice chapter 1, verse 3, the verse preceding our passage. Speaking of Jesus, he is the radiance of his glory. He's the exact representation of his nature, and he upholds all things by the word of his power. The writer of Hebrews, speaking of Jesus, says that Jesus and the Father share the exact same representation. They share the exact same nature, that the Father and the Son are one. That's what it means to be a son, to share the same nature as the Father, to often share the likeness of the Father. My son was playing a football game recently and a referee looks out and he scores a touchdown and he turns to me and goes, that's your son, isn't it? I was like, yeah, because we're hair twins. I mean, it's just obvious on a field of 20 kids who's my kid is because we have the same hair, that the son often shares a representation of the father. But it's not just representation. It's not just likeness. In fact, in verse 5, the writer of Hebrews is chosen to quote from Psalm chapter 2, referring to this title of son, because the son, according to Psalm chapter 2, which was an enthronement psalm, was describing the fact that the son was also going to be the heir to the father, that he was going to rule the father's kingdom, that he would receive the inheritance of the father. So to be son isn't just to share a representation, but it's also to become the future heir and ruler. One of my passions that's become my nightmares is the Dallas Cowboys, and this is Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones, all right? Jerry Jones, that's on the left, is the owner and general manager of the Dallas Cowboys, and to the right is his son, Stephen Jones. Now, For those of y'all who don't suffer like I do as a Dallas Cowboys fan, may not realize that Jerry Jones has multiple kids. In fact, he has multiple sons. But Stephen Jones, that is here to his right, shares not just a likeness with his father, but he also is the chosen son. He's the one that's going to take over the operations of the Dallas Cowboys. He's not just sharing in representation with his father, but he is going to be heir of the team and of the operation of the precious franchise that is the Dallas Cowboys. And can someone come and please save it soon, quickly, please, right? That's what it means to be son, is to share likeness and to be a future ruler and heir of what is to come. Why is that significant, and why is the writer of Hebrews starting the argument here as he talks about an audience that is worshiping in this place, idols or angels that are secondary in a place that is primary? It's this: that they believed angels as they worshiped them were not just to be worshiped, but they believed that they were going to rule the coming kingdom that was to come. And so for them, they had placed angels in a place as the source of security and stability in their life. That if they were going to rule the kingdom that was to come, then they were ones that could be trusted to provide stability and security in their life. And what the writer of Hebrews is trying to say is, no. They're not going to rule the coming kingdom. Jesus is. And if Jesus is going to rule the coming kingdom, then he is the source of security in our lives. Notice where he goes, beginning in verse 8, when he says, "But of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. You have loved righteousness, you have hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions. You, O Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth. The heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. And all that you've created will become old like a garment, and like a mantle you're going to roll them up, and like a garment that's going to be changed. But you are the same, and your years will not come to an end." Verse 13, "But to which of the angels has he ever said, 'Sit in my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet'?" The writer of Hebrews is trying to correct his audience's misunderstanding to say, no, angels are not going to rule the world that is to come. Jesus will, which is why Jesus is better, which is why he is a son to the Father and not the angels. So if there's one that's going to be in charge of what is to come, if there's one that is the source of security, it's Jesus, it's not the angels. What the writer of Hebrews is trying to help his audience see is that Jesus as son provides us security, that he's the ultimate source of security. A situation unfolded in the last 48 hours for us in which I thought something was about to be done circumstantially that was going to be incredibly helpful and good, and it began to kind of unravel and fall apart at one point on Friday. And as I was doing it, I was getting incredibly frustrated because I wanted something sealed and done before I headed off to spring break and kind of let life kind of unfold on the backside of that clarity and decision that could have been made. And when it began to fall apart, I got really frustrated. And so for a moment, I decided I was just going to check out, and I needed to kind of escape my frustration. And so I went to Twitter thinking I'd find something on sports. And what Jesus did and said, which is kind of funny, and it doesn't normally happen to me this way, but I ran across two quotes on my Twitter feed, all right, literally on this topic. And I was like, all right, Lord, I got it. And the first was from Bob Goff, all right? And here's what he said. This is fascinating to me, thinking about the week that was unfolding for me. In which it said, Bob Goff says, "The way we deal with uncertainty says a lot about whether Jesus is ahead of us leading or behind us just carrying our stuff." Man. Paul David Tripp said it this way: "When you're placing your trust in the sovereign rule of the King of Kings, you won't crave power and you don't need to be in control." I don't know about you in the midst of circumstances or where you are in the midst of this season. I know spring break's right around the corner, which feels fun, but for many of us, maybe there's some elements or there's some pockets of real uncertainty in life. Maybe we're not sure about something with our child. Maybe we're not sure about something with a business. Maybe we're not sure with some finances or a family or health. And there's all kinds of swirling uncertainty that may be there for so many of us. And I find myself waffling between these places of, I don't think I want control, but I just want certainty. Like, I just want to know, Lord, what do you have? I don't need to control it, but I sure would like maybe the timing of it to reach certainty by this point, right? In the midst of that kind of wash, I was just reminded this week that there's so many things that we attribute and we look for to provide us security and stability in our lives. There's certainty that we want. There's clarity that we want. There's circumstances that we want unfolded in a certain kind of way. And one of the things I was just reminded this week walking through this passage is, look, Jesus is the only provider of security. That everything else is a mirage, everything else is a sham. It's a perceived sense of stability and security. that Jesus alone provides us a security that cannot be shaken, that cannot be thwarted, and that cannot be checked. And what the writer of Hebrews is trying to do for his audience, and what I think he does for us, the Spirit that's working, is to say, all of those idols, all of those things that we attribute a false sense of security pale in comparison to the true provider of security in our life. So I want to ask for you, if you think about those circumstances in your life, or you think about those things that you attribute security to, what are they? What are those things that feel like they bring security and stability to your life? We wouldn't necessarily say that they're idols, but often when they become removed or they become like a rug that gets pulled out from under us, that kind of instability, that kind of chaos is often what is revealed by something that we've made primary that should have been secondary. So the writer Hebrews is trying to drive to that point for his audience, and I think he's trying to drive to that for us as well. Do we trust the Lord? Do we recognize that he's the only one that provides security in our lives, and that all other provisions of security from all other sources are merely mirages, that we just have to trust him and walk step by step? The next thing the writer of Hebrews wants to do here is not just highlight the title of Jesus, but he wants to highlight the task of Jesus. Notice what he's gonna do here in verse 6. He's gonna move us from a sense of the fact that Jesus provides security, and he's gonna move us to an understanding that Jesus also provides us satisfaction. Notice what he does here in verse 6. Speaking of Jesus, and when he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, and let all the angels of God worship him. It's interesting as you think about what was going on for this original audience that they had actually been worshiping angels. We don't necessarily do that, but they had been. And they had placed, in a sense, with angels, a sense of provision in their lives and even a sense of satisfaction in their lives. And what the writer of Hebrews is trying to do is say, why would you worship something less when something even better is right there? Every single night in our home, there's a certain pattern that ensues. We have dinner, we sit down at the dinner table together in the midst of all the things that are happening, and we have a sweet moment, connect, have conversations about the day. But about 5 minutes before any of us are done eating, our son has typically finished first, and he ends up asking the same question every time. It's not like, how was your day, or some kind of probing, really insightful question. He just quickly wants to get to dessert, and so he'll always ask, hey, can I have dessert? And at this point in time, typically we've tried to push him off, or we've tried to say, hey, we're gonna all have dessert at the same time together, but eventually at this point, we just kind of let it go. We're like, sure, fine. And here's what he does every single night is he runs to our back freezer and he grabs one of these cheap drumstick ice cream cones, okay? I have zero idea why, but he just loves these with all the might that he has, okay? And at this point in time, you have to also understand, I'm fine with him eating these because in the same freezer, I have like 2 to 3 cartons of different flavors of Bluebell ice cream. And if he keeps going for the drumsticks, then he's not gonna threaten my supply of Bluebell. So eat your heart out, little buddy, on these drumsticks, all right? So what's the point of this? The point is this, not that I am a selfish father that lets my child have worse ice creams, but he just is just utterly content with, frankly, something that is lesser, right? Why would you be content with a drumstick when Bluebell is just sitting there? In the hierarchy of ice creams, there's a clear distinction and a clear order in the universe, right? Bluebell, drumsticks, maybe Haagen-Dazs, but I can't afford Haagen-Dazs. Bluebell, right? That's the order of ice creams, okay? And then there's Blue Bunny that's like somewhere down here, okay? Creamy Creations, we can kind of have it fluctuating. I know we're all in different places with Creamy Creations, all right? That's not the point in the morning or the point in the message, all right? It's this. He's content with something far lesser when something greater is right there. What the writer Hebrews is trying to draw his attention of his audience to is that they are worshiping and they've grown content in finding their satisfaction in something far lesser when something greater is right there. And because of that, that contentment turns inside of itself and turns on itself and becomes disappointment and it becomes regret when we worship something that is lesser. The writer Hebrews wants his audience to recognize that it's going to be angels that actually worship Jesus. Verse six again, and let all the angels of God worship him. So the writer's point to his audience is obvious. Why are you worshiping that which is going to turn around and worship Christ? Why don't you worship that which is ultimate? And for them, it's not just worship, but it's about their sense and source of satisfaction, that which satisfies us becomes that which we often worship. I feed our dog, which is why he follows me wherever I go, right? That where our satisfaction is found often is what we worship. It's what we give our whole lives to. It's what we give our whole self to. So the writer of Hebrews is trying to draw their attention to the fact that they're worshiping something lesser, and they place their contentment and their satisfaction in a source that can never satisfy to the extent that the ultimate provider of satisfaction can, which is Jesus. I want to ask you this morning, as you think about your own self and you kind of reflective, if Jesus as a son provides us ultimate satisfaction, then where is it you are going to find satisfaction? What are those false pursuits and those secondary pursuits that you place your hopes and your dreams and your expectations upon that will not ultimately satisfy? I love this quote from C.S. Lewis when he says it this way. God made us. He invented us as a man invents an engine. Now, God designed the human machine to run on himself. He himself is the fuel of our spirits that were designed to burn, or the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other. That's why it's just no good asking God to make us happy in our own way. God cannot give us a happiness and a peace apart from him. There is no such thing. Hebrews chapter 1 opens up in a pretty challenging way to say, for an audience that was placing that which was secondary in a place that was primary, he says, you've missed it. That Jesus is the ultimate provider of security and he's the ultimate provider of satisfaction. But what I love about how our passage ends and how this section ends is that it isn't about therefore recognizing that and then just assembling around Jesus and becoming a spectator as to his glory and his grandeur, but it moves us in a completely opposite direction, not gathering around and becoming stagnant, but moving out. It's basketball season. Many of us know that A&M is about to play a massive game today at 12. We'll get you home in time. Probably not. And if they win, they're in the tournament, hopefully, right? Big game, huge game. But in basketball, that there's moments where you can just see utter greatness on the court. I'm a Dallas Mavericks fan. I have a huge, not idol, but crush on Luka Doncic, all right? Last summer, I was thinking back to even just the documentary on Michael Jordan, who I got to watch grow up with, and I thought about what would it be like to play with these massive phenoms on the basketball court? Like, how great would it be to actually catch a pass, to shoot a basket, to make a pick? How great would it be to be on the court with them? The more and more I think about it, the more and more I feel like, man, what would be really hard is I think in the midst of their greatness, I would have a tendency to just start to watch, right? I would stop moving and I would stop playing, and I think I would want to just watch them perform like a spectator and like a fan, which is not what the game of basketball is about. But what idols do is they attribute and they pull all that we have to assemble around them and to give all that we have to them, and the end goal of the entire thing is to assemble and to stop and to focus on that. What makes Jesus different is where this passage ends, is it's not about attributing and assembling for worship in and of itself around him, but he's gonna move us out. And what we're gonna see as this passage moves is that Jesus' second task is not just to receive worship, but he's going to dispatch representatives. Notice again, verse 7. And of the angels, he says, who makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire? That notice there's a ministry that these angels are gonna have. There's a purpose that they're gonna have. He's literally going to dispatch them for a purpose and for a end goal and result. He finishes or follows up on that in verse 14, and he says, are they not all ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation? It's interesting, as he kind of talks about the angels, what we begin to realize and what he's trying to correct for his audience is that these angels were not just gathering in worship as if that's all that they were intended to do, as if they were just gonna behold his glory and they were stopping there and they're done. No. In the midst of that beholding of glory, then that which was ultimately glorious, God himself would then dispatch them for ministry and for service. And if that's what is true of the angels, then it is also obviously true of you and I. That if he dispatches the angels to be representatives of his as ministers that are sent out, then so we are as the church, also that church which is commissioned. One day a week, we gather here around him who is infinitely worthy, and we give of our worship and we give of ourselves to him. But 6 days of the other part of the week, we are the church that is not gathered, but the church that's commissioned and sent out. That as representatives in our communities and our workplaces of him who's infinitely glorious, who is the ultimate source of security and satisfaction. And if the angels are dispatched, then so are we. And that's where the writer of Hebrews is trying to wrap up and draw his audience to it in terms of a closing. What do we do with this? that if Jesus is the ultimate source of security and satisfaction, then what do we do is that you and I recognize that we are also those that are dispatched out and commissioned. As we roll towards spring break with Easter 4 weeks away, thinking about how you and I can be dispatched, here, let me give you a couple ideas and a couple suggestions, especially now that the weather, hopefully in 24 hours, will begin to warm up finally, right? Over the next 4 weeks is a great opportunity to make some fresh investments in the community that the Lord has placed you in. If you look down your street, if you look around the hallway of your apartment complex or wherever it is, can you name the people that are living five doors to your left and five doors to your right? If you can't name them or put their names on a map, then you're probably not very far in spiritual conversations with them. If you know Jesus Christ, then you are representatives that have been dispatched and commissioned into the very communities that he sovereignly placed you into. My question for you this morning is, are you making representation for him who is the ultimate source of security and salvation and satisfaction? Are you building bridges so that others can get to know this one who you worship and who you call King? Next 4 weeks is an awesome opportunity to take moments and to begin to think through how can you begin to build some bridges and deepen some relationships right in the very community that the Lord has placed you. One of my favorite things to do, and we'll do this often as the weather warms and as we head towards summer, is just neighborhood block party. Just inviting neighbors out as it gets warm that you haven't seen them for 3 or 4 months because it's been freezing, inviting them out and creating some gatherings where the neighbors are getting to know one another. We've had new people move in and out of our cul-de-sac, and it's been a great opportunity to begin to befriend and deepen those relationships. And so one of the questions I want to extend to you is, do you know your neighbors? Can you name them? Do you know their stories if you know them by name? Do you know their background? Do you know, spiritually speaking, where they stand? Do they know Jesus Christ? Do they have a spiritual background? Do they have a story at all? The next 4 weeks are a great opportunity as we come into some warmer weather to begin to be back outside, to play outside, to gather outside, to connect with one another, and to get to know the very people that the Lord has placed you around. Those 4 weeks of investment can lead to a great opportunity as we head toward Easter for a broader and more bold spiritual conversation. Maybe you invite them to church, or maybe you invite them to an Easter meal, or maybe you invite them to a brunch on Easter Sunday at your house. But either way, as we move toward these next 4 weeks, it gives us an awesome opportunity as we think through the calendar and think through where we're headed and kind of the flow of the spring toward Easter Sunday. Maybe inviting them to church, but even more so, just deepening relationships, deepening conversations, speaking of the hope that we have, especially the hope that we celebrate on Easter Sunday. I want to push on us a little bit as we head toward spring break and as we head toward Easter, that we begin to be intentional where the Lord's placed us. It doesn't have to be you in and of yourself and by yourself, but if you're in a small group or if you're in a community, make it a team sport. Make it something that we do together. I know some of you guys, I know that some of y'all live around others that are even here at Southwood in the same neighborhoods. And so make it a team sport and take it on yourselves together to really befriend and reach out and deepen some conversations and deepen some relationships over the next 4 weeks to have an even easier opportunity to speak more boldly about the hope that we have come Easter Sunday. That's our hope, is that we would be dispatched as representatives of where the Lord has placed us. Personally, realizing that our ultimate source of satisfaction and security is in Jesus. Corporately, recognizing that we move out not just as a church only that's been gathered, but a church that's been commissioned to represent Jesus in the communities and the workplaces that he's put us. I want to close here with this one last quote from Shauna Nyquist. As you think about the home that you've been placed in, whether that's an apartment complex or whether that's a home or whatever neighborhood you find yourself, she says this, that we throw open the front door and we invite people into our home, despite its size, despite its imperfections, that we practice hospitality, creating safe, soft and safe places for people to connect and rest. Your homes that the Lord has provided for you, the places that you live, are not coincidental, they're not circumstantial, they're not accidental, but he sovereignly placed you there for a purpose, to open your doors, to build relationships and to deepen them with those that you live alongside of and beside. And the question is, how will you use your proximity in the next 4 weeks? How will you use it this spring and this summer to build relationships, to deepen conversations, and ultimately have the opportunity to share the gospel? Our hope as a church is not just that we are a church that's gathered, but that we are a church that's commissioned, helping people find and follow Jesus wherever we find ourselves, wherever the Lord's placed us, whether that's in our communities or in our workplaces. I'm gonna pray for us, and then we're gonna have the opportunity to respond in worship this morning, thinking of him who is our ultimate source of satisfaction, our ultimate source of security, who's going to establish a kingdom that's coming one day. So let me pray for us this morning. Lord God, we just come before you and we confess and we admit that there are so many secondary things and sometimes inappropriate things that we try to find our satisfaction in. And time again, they do not satisfy. Time and time again, they lead to disappointment, they lead to regret, or they just lead to disillusionment. Because we continue to place that which is secondary in a place that is primary in our lives, and it happens subtly and it happens so often that we often don't even see it directly. And so in the midst of those circumstantial things, in the midst of those moments where either you convict or life unfolds in ways that reveals the things that we've placed in a place that should be secondary, but we've made them primary, Lord, it creates chaos. It creates instability. And Lord, I pray that you would give us hearts that are responsive to hear your voice in those moments, trusting you, responding back to your invitation to come back, knowing and believing and proclaiming that Jesus is better. Better than all the false promises, better than all the other opportunities, situations, relationships, and things that we run to, that first and foremost, that your son is better, that he's better.